Welcome to Stateside, everyone. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this rainy Monday. Entrepreneurship is on the rise in West Michigan. We take a look at just what this means for the Grand Rapids area and the rest of the state. Then, when you consider all the possible fixes being discussed for struggling big cities like Detroit, there is an idea being offered up that has truly stood the test of time: attract more immigrants. And later in the program, we'll hear how a University of Michigan professor is using archaeology to tell the story of undocumented immigrants who are crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S. But first, Michigan now has the fourth highest rate in the nation of parents who do not have their children vaccinated for religious, medical, and other reasons. Many simply don't get all the immunization shots that are required. Despite adamant statements from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control that vaccines have no link to autism, an anti-vaccination movement is growing online from parent to parent and through activist celebrities such as actress Jenny McCarthy. August is National Immunization Awareness Month, so physicians are mounting fresh efforts to get more Michigan kids fully vaccinated. This push begins as the number of children falling ill with preventable diseases is on the rise. We wanted to see just how this story is being played out in the examination rooms of a busy pediatric practice day in and day out. Joining us in the studio is Oakland County pediatrician Dr. Martin Levinson. He has been practicing pediatrics for 33 years. So in that time, how have you seen the resistance grow to having a child vaccinated?
Well, there's to some extent a pendulum effect. It sort of waxes and wanes. Being that I've been in practice this long, I've been around to see a lot of the diseases that the newer doctors are totally unfamiliar with because they essentially don't exist anymore because of our vaccination program. So that sort of taints my point of view because I have seen the complications that occur from this illnesses, and I am just so frustrated with my inability to convince 100% of my patients. We get in the high 90 range, but it's an effort. Now, I don't mind the effort because I don't mind parents wanting to question and asking me, are you sure this is the right thing to do? But it's still very frustrating when they decide to their child's detriment to hold off on vaccines, to change the schedule, etc. They do it because they think that they're actually protecting their child, and in reality, they're doing just the opposite.
Before we get into the reasons you hear and having you respond to that, what kind of price is being paid now as far as the health of children and really public health in Michigan because we're seeing
good
people
point.
Not
it's not only the children who are not vaccinated, but it's also other children that can be affected by it. The most recent example that I can tell you about is there was a big outbreak in Brooklyn this summer of measles. It started with a group of kids who came from England, where the vaccination rate has been traditionally even lower than here. And then, because it's an extremely contagious disease, people who were not vaccinated here were getting ill. And then you have the opposite of the herd effect, which is that children who were vaccinated but did not receive great protection from their vaccinations because nothing is 100% ended up getting measles despite trying to do everything they could to prevent it. And this is the natural process that happens. We actually have a sign up in our office. I don't know how effective it is, but It's a big sign that says, if you choose to not vaccinate your children, please do not have them sit in our waiting area because it's putting our other patients at risk.
We talked about measles. What about whooping cough? What about here in Michigan?
Well,
what are
whooping
we
cough is probably the one that is the most notable on the rise. The reason it's been on the rise is that the success of the vaccine itself is a little bit lower than some of the others. And number two, there's a diminution of the protection with time. So teenagers, young adults have a higher percent of being available to get it and carry it. So we started a vaccine program a number of years ago where now they get a booster dose of whooping cough going into sixth grade. We also urge all pregnant women and all caretakers of newborn babies to get an updated whooping cough vaccine. Okay. And that will work if people do it, and more people indeed are doing it. But unfortunately, the numbers of whooping cough are going up. Whooping cough in infants is an extremely serious disease, life-threatening disease. whooping cough in a teenager or an adult is a very frustrating disease. You can cough very impressively. It's the classic 100-day cough. And some of my parents who have had it have said to me, I had no clue how bad this was going to be. I always just thought it was going to be a week of illness, and that was it.
I think that even the term, it makes it, it kind of, as you say, there's a, it diminishes the severity of what this is about. And what about mumps? Are we seeing an increase in that?
Well, we see little outbreaks of mumps. Okay. The mumps goes along with the measles. It's part of one vaccine. And, you know, this all goes back to that one study that has been discredited completely that started to say there was a connection between the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, and autism. It has been thoroughly disproven. The information that was published was wrong. Lancet has rescinded the article.
Didn't the authors even take their names off the study?
All the authors but the primary author, correct.
Okay.
And, you know, there were some – well, it's interesting because I have this conversation with patients, and I've even had patients say, well, I think he was railroaded. I think that he was – trying to be a whistleblower, and they stopped him, which is just plain not true. Believe me, when all this comes out, we take it seriously. We look at it. We try to see maybe there is a better way. Maybe we should be doing something differently. We took all the thimerosal, the mercury preservative out of the vaccines because it made sense to not put that in kids' bodies. And there was a question whether that was related to developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. What happened? Not a thing. Nothing. And we knew this in advance because other countries had done it even ahead of us, and it also found no difference. Now, is it better to not have the preservative in babies? Just empirically, yes, although there's no hard data that says that that's true. And it certainly, unfortunately, made the vaccines more expensive by doing so. Now, that's a price that's a willing price to pay if it accomplishes something. There's nothing wrong with people feeling better about it.
I'm speaking with pediatrician Dr. Martin Levinson, who's been practicing in Oakland County for the last 33 years, looking at the fact that Michigan now has the fourth highest rate in the nation of parents who don't have their children vaccinated for a number of reasons. So let's get to what you hear day in, day out as you go to examine a child and you hear from the parents. What are the reasons that they fear having their child vaccinated?
The typical reasons are, I'm just not comfortable that they're safe. Mm-hmm. There's too many vaccines at one time. I would rather spread them out. These are the kinds of things. And, of course, there's people who say, I have a neighbor with an autistic child, and they told me that the reason was the vaccine. So I'm not sure I want to vaccinate my kids. I think I'm putting my kids at risk.
What do you say to those who say, we did not vaccinate and everybody's healthy and happy?
I say, congratulations on your luck. That comes up all the time, especially like with flu vaccinations. Mm-hmm. People say, well, I don't get the flu vaccine and we don't get the flu. Everyone gets exposed to the flu. Everyone will be exposed. If you've been lucky enough to not have the flu, congratulations. But your luck is going to run out at some point, just probability-wise. And people who get the flu after not having it for a long time all of a sudden realize, you know, I thought this was a nothing thing. This is a bad disease. I did not like having this.
Where can parents who really want to get good information and educate themselves, where should they go?
There are a lot of websites. The problem we run into is the conspiracy theory. There are people who feel that this is a government conspiracy and they're not going to get the right information.
That is out there. Yeah, that popped right up as I was
absolutely,
doing my research.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, has a website with links to studies about vaccine safety and the reasoning behind it. But there's a distrust from some families about anything that comes out of the doctors or the, you know, the CDC's literature.
And what are your main concerns for public health really throughout our state if this continues and people resist vaccinations?
Well, the main concern if people increase with this is that you're going to have more and more people getting these illnesses. You'll go through cycles. The pertussis always is a cyclical disease. We know that. It's on the upswing. I think there were over 800 cases last year, if I'm not mistaken, in Michigan, and that's up. We always worry that there's going to be a larger number of people, and then it'll be a snowballing effect because, again, the vaccinations are not 100%. So the more illness that's out there, the more chance you have of your child or you yourself getting sick, even though you took all the precautions that were available to you.
Dr. Martin Levinson is a pediatrician in Oakland County, kind enough to join us in the studio. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Let's turn now to Lansing. A federal judge says a ruling that Michigan's juvenile lifer law is unconstitutional applies to all inmates in state prisons, sentences juveniles to automatic life without parole. The American Civil Liberties Union says that means more than 360 inmates are entitled to new sentencing hearings. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette wanted the ruling applied very narrowly. He says it's not fair to families of murder victims who thought those responsible would never be eligible for release. Still to come, in just the last 4 years, there's been a big change in the way people think about being entrepreneurs. What does this change in mindset mean for Michigan? And a U of M anthropologist is studying the recent past, looking at items left behind by undocumented immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border.
We've been able to come in and apply very rigorous, systematic archaeological techniques to try to understand what do the things that people leave behind tell us about this really complicated process.
That story in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you consider all the possible fixes being discussed for struggling big cities like Detroit, there is an idea being offered up that has truly stood the test of time: attract more immigrants. It's the way cities have been built all through American history. You open the doors to people who are hungry for a new life, for new opportunities, and then you watch them pour their energy into building new businesses, improving their homes and neighborhoods, and attracting more new residents as family members follow from the old country. But immigrants are not coming to Detroit, and that's something my next guest hopes to change. Steve DeBachman is the director of Global Detroit. So far, Global Detroit has launched over a half dozen distinct initiatives to make Southeast Michigan and Detroit more welcoming to immigrants. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Well, it's real clear that Metro Detroit has a percentage of foreign-born immigrants. It's pretty similar to the rest of the nation, but tell us, what's the percentage within the city of Detroit?
Yeah, so we just completed Global Detroit, a demographic study, and looked at how many foreign-born there are in the region and where they live. And what we found is that, you know, Detroit metro area, Southeast Michigan, really is one of the Midwest bright shining points of attracting immigrants. And the region is the second most foreign-born after Chicago. But what we see is a marked distinction between the city of Detroit and the surrounding counties. The counties are all close to 10% or more foreign-born, which is relatively close to the national average, and twice that of the state of Michigan. Detroit, however, is close to 5% foreign-born and is half the national average and less than the average in the state of Michigan.
And you point out in the piece you wrote on ModelDMedia.com, Detroit has the lowest percentage of immigrants of any of the 25 largest cities in the nation. So why do you think this disparity exists?
Well, I think that immigrants have bypassed Detroit for the suburban communities for the same reasons that African-Americans and other folks in the region have chosen to relocate to the suburbs. There are still new immigrant groups coming into the city, but you're often seeing up and out instead of the kind of immigrant enclaves that you would see in Chicago or Philadelphia, Boston, New York, or other cities. And so the perceptions of safety, the issues of public services, the location of jobs and employers, those are all reasons, the schools That immigrants are choosing to settle in the suburbs and bypass the city of Detroit.
And yet it's such a battle cry for you and for Global Detroit that the city can benefit by having foreign-born residents. Give us an idea, Steve DeBachman, the unique benefits to a city that immigrants bring.
Detroit is actually got some great appeal for some of the foreign-born. It's got very low-cost real estate. There are lots of retail opportunities and spaces that are abandoned that might have somewhat lower demand, but frankly are underserved. And there are many Detroiters who want to have retail in their neighborhood. And so it's fairly easy for immigrant groups like the Bangladeshi have done and Hamtramck and like the Yemenis have done in Dearborn and like the Hispanic community has done in Southwest Detroit, to build enclaves where their native tongue is spoken, where they're integrating and creating new communities with Detroiters, long-term Detroiters. And the benefits for Detroiters, as the former state representative from Southwest Detroit, I can tell you that improved safety from more eyes and ears on the street, more utilization of the parks and the schools to stabilize them, more economic activity, and then obviously from in the wake of the bankruptcy, more tax revenue for the local unit of government.
Now, you talk about this idea of micro economies existing within these ethnic enclaves. So give us a real good example. And do they help support the city at large?
Oh, absolutely. If you look, for example, at the grocery stores in Southwest Detroit, you can find a half dozen really blossoming grocery stores that exist. They cater to the Hispanic community. This would include Prince Gigante Valley. It would include Honeybee Market, E&L Meats, and many others. The community comes from Mexico and other countries in Latin America where there's a tradition of going to your local market, of buying fresh produce, of shopping for fresh meats and for cooking at home and not utilizing some of the other, you know, fast food establishments and other things sometimes. And so these markets are well-stocked, and you've seen that not just Hispanics, but people all across the city of Detroit are coming to Southwest Detroit because of the quality of its grocery stores. And a grocery store can be a real community revitalization tool.
Steve, talk to us about the initiatives that Global Detroit's launching with the hopes of attracting more immigrants to Detroit.
Well, we are a regional initiative. We do see our work in the city of Detroit is very important to the entire region, but we also work in Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, and Washtenaw counties. Some of our work is focused on the highly educated and skilled immigrants that are empowering the new economy, the tech industries. In fact, immigrants have created over a third of the high-tech firms over the last 10 years in our state. And so we've launched the first international student retention program in the country to retain international students from Michigan colleges and universities. We have launched a regional welcoming initiative as part of the Welcoming America national campaign to build immigrant-friendly communities, and we are in Hamtramck, Sterling Heights, and in the Chadsey Condon neighborhood in Southwest Detroit. We've launched a welcome mat to connect new arrivals with traditional integration services, including English language classes, citizenship classes. And in the city of Detroit, we have launched a very exciting initiative called Prosperous Detroit that seeks to tap into the hidden talents of immigrants and African Americans and low-income communities. And this is a micro-enterprise training, lending, and development program. We hope to be a national leader in creating and sustaining businesses, small businesses, many in the service industry, so construction trades, landscaping, janitorial services, food making services, you know, seamstresses, all those kinds of things that folks in Detroit have been doing for generations to sustain themselves, but turning them into profitable businesses and businesses that that build communities.
Looking in the future, Steve DeBachman, and as the director of Global Detroit, you're going to be a part of the conversation. When the bankruptcy is in the rearview mirror, when Kevin Orr is gone and there is a mayor, there is city council, what can those leaders do in the city of Detroit and then in other struggling Michigan cities to attract more foreign-born residents and keep them in the city instead of using it as a jumping-off point for the suburbs?
The biggest thing people can do is to lay out the welcome mat and to be welcoming. This is not about any kind of special incentives or tax benefits for immigrants, but it is about creating integrated communities that work. And if we are welcoming to the folks that are already here, they will bring other folks. That is the most successful way to build immigration pipelines for international investment, for international talent, and for new residents in Michigan. We're the only state that lost population over the last 10 years, and really the only growth we've seen in the United States has been through international immigrations, and that's particularly true for cities. There are a number of sort of economic gardening or low-cost things people can do to be welcoming. They can make sure that there's access and information about nonprofits that help integrate immigrants, and then they can look at the talent needs that their industries have, be they in information technology. And, of course, we want to encourage long-term Michigan residents to get those skills to fill the needs in the healthcare industry and the IT industry and in engineering. And at the same time, there are shorter term opportunities that the international community brings through international students. And we've found that just by creating Global Talent Retention Initiative, the country's first international student retention program, we're getting inquiries from Ivy League schools, from PhD chemists at Kansas State University, from all across the country, because nobody has really marketed themselves as a place where international talent, international investment can come. And given Michigan and Detroit's challenges over the last decade and the transformation that we're going from a high-wage manufacturing community to being more of a knowledge-based economy, we think it's important that this tool be part of the toolkit that Michigan communities have, that the city of Detroit has. This has been a time-tested strategy, and I challenge one to find significant urban revitalization anywhere in America over the last 10 years that hasn't included at least some component of international migration, of immigration at its core. And it's about integrating those populations with the existing populations to creating the American dream for all of us.
Certainly no shortage of ideas from our guest, Steve Tobachman, Director of Global Detroit. Thank you for sharing those ideas with us today, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.
What's the state of entrepreneurship in West Michigan? That's the question tackled in a new report from Grand Valley State University's Seidman College of Business. It found that in just 4 years, there's been a big shift in the way people think about being entrepreneurs. We wanted to take a closer look at that changing mindset and find out just what it means, not only for West Michigan, but for the state. Paul Isley is chairman of the economics department at Grand Valley State Seidman College of Business, and he joins us now from GVSU. Your team last examined the climate for entrepreneurs in West Michigan back in 2009. So what were the biggest changes you found over these past 4 years?
Well, over those 4 years, the major change that really started to happen was a change in the mindset of all business people on this side of the state in looking towards entrepreneurship to either improve their business internally or to generate new jobs through new businesses. So that had changed quite drastically. We also saw an increase in the availability of professionally managed capital. So there was now starting to be a flow of funds that was available for firms to access to be entrepreneurial.
Because you can have all the great ideas in the world, but if you don't have that lifeblood of capital, it's not going to happen.
Exactly. If you don't have something to leverage and bring it through the development process and into market, it will die.
And are people turning to being entrepreneurs? Is this mindset change happening because the Great Recession left them a few other choices? Or are people just more willing to take the risk today in 2013?
I think there's a little bit of both. Certainly, when I talk to my students from before the Great Recession, they would talk about things like, I'm going to go work for Company X. Now they say, well, I'm looking at Company X, but I also have something going with four friends over here. And that's really a thought process of, you know, maybe we can't trust getting into business the way we could before. But on the other hand, we're starting to see that up and down the business chain here on this side of the state, we hear business leaders talk about that it's okay to fail. It's okay to come up with an idea. It's okay to fail and then come up with another idea. And so there's starting to be a celebration of this sort of entrepreneurial spirit.
So don't be afraid to flop. Don't be afraid to fall on your face.
Exactly. I mean, you want to fail fast. You want to bring out an idea. If it doesn't fly, you move on.
How does this changing mindset and this growing acceptance of stepping out and flying on your own, how does it compare? You found it in West Michigan. What do you think it compares with the rest of the state?
Well, it's certainly starting to pick up here in the west side of the state. The entrepreneurial hotbed in the state has always been right around Ann Arbor. As people come out of a research university and have very strong ideas, there's a good draw of capital there. So compared to that, we're not there yet. But compared to other cities that don't have a University of Michigan sitting there or a college like that, we're doing very well.
And I correct me if I'm wrong, but you found 63% of the new jobs created in Grand Rapids since the recession came from new businesses. So that has to tell you that this is really not just a blip.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, from the depth of the recession through 2011, 63% of the jobs. And without that bump, we would have been growing at the same rate as the rest of the United States. But with that bump, we were growing more than twice as fast as the rest of the United States. That's a big deal.
What kinds of jobs are these, Paul?
Well, we're seeing them across the board. We're seeing bumps in IT jobs, which has been a very fast-growing sector. We certainly are seeing healthcare jobs, but we're seeing those healthcare jobs not only occur in the providing of healthcare, but also healthcare manufacturing, creating new ideas, generating patents around healthcare, doing those sorts of things. Those are two very strong areas, but we're also still seeing growth in manufacturing.
Now, so you've seen this change in mindset, and it seems to be something that really has taken root. You say there is more available professionally managed capital, but I get the sense from looking at the report that issue of capital still remains kind of a stumbling block.
It certainly is. I mean, drawing capital from outside of Michigan into Michigan, when they hear about things like the Detroit bankruptcy and their view of Michigan is very Detroit-centric, can be very hard. And we also have a mindset that we really want to have control of what we do on this side of the state. So it's one of the reasons why we leave SBIR, STT, our money on the table. I mean, we access that money at a lower rate than many other cities.
And what is that money? What do those initials stand for?
It's money that comes from the federal government through small business, and it's attached to research that's being done at various levels of government. And it's a very good way to get started as far as getting some capital to get an idea moving through the process. And it requires paperwork. It requires people to do things. And we're accessing it more than we did in 2009, but just we aren't doing it at the same rate as other cities around us.
So what do you feel can be done on a statewide level to lend more support to business owners, not only in West Michigan, but really throughout the state of Michigan, to the folks that have that dream and maybe decided, you know what, the time is right. I'm going to take that leap. What needs to be done to support them even more?
Well, certainly at the governmental level, we're already seeing that movement. The perception of all levels of government right now as being supportive of this was very strong in our surveys. And we saw large shifts in the cost of doing business because of changes in the way government was doing things here. So I think the governmental policies are already moving in the right directions. Really, our big issue right now is rebranding Michigan. So that we aren't seen as that rusty state that is so tied to automotive they can't think of anything else. That's important.
And what do you think will take to do that rebranding? Is it going to come from the kids sitting in your class today?
I think it's going to come from the next generation. I think it's going to be very hard for us to just tell people there's a difference. It's going to happen over time. And so this new crop of entrepreneurs that are starting lots of jobs right now across a wide swath of industry types, that word is going to get out. And if there's good ideas happening here, money will come.
Paul Isley is the chairman of the economics department at Grand Valley State's Seidman College of Business, and he joined us from the campus in Grand Rapids. Paul, thank you for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, how one man is using archaeology and science to understand the journey of undocumented migrants to the U.S. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is much talk and much movement in Washington about reforming our broken immigration system. It seems to have bipartisan support. But what do we know about the life stories of these migrants? Well, that's a question that has led my next guest to apply his scientific training in anthropology and archaeology to discovering the thousands of stories of these migrants. Jason DeLeon is a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. And he directs the Undocumented Migration Project, UMP. His collection is now the largest body of migrant artifacts in the nation, with more than 10,000 items, everything from shoes to water bottles to love letters and photographs. Jason joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your interest, Jason, in preserving the artifacts and in that uncovering the stories of these migrants coming from northern Mexico to the southern Arizona desert, it's a personal one. This goes back a long ways with you, doesn't it?
It does. I think that this project for me developed out of a variety of factors. I grew up in southern Texas along the border, about 8 miles from Mexico. I had many family members who were undocumented, including my grandparents. And my mom was an immigrant from the Philippines. So immigration was something that's always been kind of in my background. But I started working in Mexico as a graduate student, doing archaeology in a very traditional sense, working on Aztec stuff, working on even earlier civilizations such as the Olmec. And I got to know a lot of workmen and workwomen on these projects, local people who lived in rural, in sort of low-income communities who worked on these excavations. And many of them were migrants or mm-hmm. were preparing to migrate as well. And I saw a lot of my, I think, family members in these people that I got to know really well, and hearing their stories about what had happened to them in the desert or listening to them prepare themselves to undertake something that was so dangerous really struck a chord with me and kind of put me on the path towards where I am today.
And here you are as director of the Undocumented Migration Project. What do you and your team attempt to do? What do you see as your mission?
You know, I think our mission at the end of the day is to do good science, is to demystify this highly politicized, controversial topic and provide the general public with a more nuanced understanding of what's actually going on in southern Arizona and in northern Mexico. Because I think for me, the biggest issue is that undocumented migration and immigrants, people react very strongly to them in positive or in oftentimes quite negative ways. And it seems like everybody has a very strong opinion about immigration, but few people have a very good understanding of what it actually looks like on the ground and what's happening on U.S. soil. So for us, it's trying to take these sort of scientific approaches from anthropology and put it onto a highly politicized topic to provide the public with a better understanding.
And how do you do that? How do you operate? What do you do as part of the Undocumented Migration Project?
We try to look at immigration from a variety of different angles, and one of them being archaeology. Migrants leave a lot of stuff behind in the desert: food supplies, backpacks, first aid equipment, personal possessions. They lose these things en route, or they dispose of them as they've consumed them. And lucky for us, this stuff lays on the surface, and we've been able to come in and apply very rigorous sort of systematic archaeological techniques to try to understand what do the things that people leave behind tell us about this really complicated process. And we take the archaeology and these artifacts and we combine them with lots of interviews with migrants. I spent a lot of time in migrant shelters in Mexico talking to people as they prepare to cross or talking to them about what's happened after a crossing. And we do other things like I'm increasingly interested in the forensic side of this process and what happens to the bodies of those who don't make it, which in southern Arizona is pushing 300 people a year, known deaths a year since the late 90s. So trying to use forensics as well to understand what this process looks like for those who unfortunately don't make it.
So in essence, you're not doing anything different from the archaeologist who did the digs at Jamestown to discover how the first settlers to America lived, or archaeologists in South America or in Ireland, where you are really trying to crack that sense of how do they live, who are they?
Basically. And I think for me, the interesting thing is the archaeology that we do is really no different methodologically and oftentimes theoretically from what's going on in more ancient prehistoric sites or even in historical situations. Mm-hmm. But the reaction has been much different.
Let's talk about that, because you say you were really unprepared for the kind of negative pushback and reaction you've gotten to the project. Give me an example. What kinds of reactions?
I would say I'm probably one of the few archaeologists who gets hate mail. And if you look at like comments about this project and me personally on the internet, it gives you a good sense about how people feel about immigrants, how people feel about doing this sort of science. And
can you give us some kind of a sense of what you hear and what's said about you and your project?
I've been told that this is not science. I've been told that this is not archaeology, despite the fact that we've been funded by the National Science Foundation, despite the fact that I've published articles that have been peer-reviewed by my colleagues. I've been called things like an anchor baby, which I always want to clarify that actually, if you're going to use that term, I would be an anchor grandbaby, because both my parents were born in the U.S. and actually both my parents were military vets for 20-plus years. But a lot of personal things, and I think that it jumps very quickly from the critique of science to this critique of – or sort of, racism pops up in different ways, whether it's concern for the natural desert environment that all of a sudden people are concerned about what immigrants are doing to the desert, or whether or not I have this kind of liberal political agenda to add to this taking over of the United States by Latinos, which oftentimes pops up as well.
And really, your goal is?
My goal is to do good science. My goal is to provide hard data on this process that nobody really wants to look at directly. We all want to have strong opinions about it, but I think when we start to look at the actual data, then all of a sudden we see just how deeply implicated the American public is, myself included. Everybody who consumes food, picked or processed by undocumented people, who receive services that these immigrants provide for Americans. Once we start to look at how it's all interconnected, I think it makes people really uncomfortable.
And looking at the artifacts you have, I was watching the video on the website, undocumentedmigrationproject.com, and you're holding a child's boot. And you talked about the emotional impact that delivered to you and clearly to other people. Talk about that a little more, Jason.
It's a really hard – it's the toughest sort of science I've ever had to do, because I'm trying to collect data and theorize about human suffering and violence. And that is something that I don't think you're ever really prepared to do. I hope that it doesn't – I try very, very hard to make sure it's not clouding my judgment in terms of how I collect the data or how I'm thinking about this data. But I'm hoping that it just makes me more sensitive to the human condition. But emotionally, when we work in the summer, it can be very, very rough on a daily basis trying to collect data on the things that infants have left behind. Or, we have the unfortunate times where we can come across human remains, and then trying to both be a scientist in that context and say it's my job to document this, but at the same time recognizing that there's a lot of human suffering there that is just right on the surface. And then how do I deal with that on an emotional level and then maintain my professionalism?
And here you are with what's considered the largest body of migrant artifacts now in the country. What do you want to have happen to everything that you've collected, categorized, photographed, you've got it stored? What do you want it to have happen?
I think in a couple of things. I'd like it to be preserved forever. I think that these are important historical artifacts, and right now it's so close to the bone, I think that it's hard for a lot of people to see these things as important historical sort of artifacts. So I'm hoping that eventually museums will take on these collections, preserve them just like they would any other type of archaeological collection. But I'm also hoping that we can share this story both with the American public and with the rest of the world. We've just done an exhibit recently at Michigan that got a lot of great press. There's been interest internationally about having it travel. But ideally, I'd like a lot of this or some of this stuff to at least go back to Mexico, because I think there's a lot of migrants who have these stories and that they're not able to tell. And I think that these objects can oftentimes tell these really great stories that people aren't given the opportunities to tell. But also, I think it's important for migrants to see that there are people here in the United States who do, in fact, care deeply about these stories, because I think it really, at the end of the day, this is an American story. I mean, it's we can swap out the anti-immigrant rhetoric. We can talk about Latinos and replace Irish and jump back 100 years, and I think it's the same narrative. And trying to keep this historical connections alive is important.
Now, you have just gotten a $10,000 award from National Geographic after you were chosen as one of this year's 17 emerging explorers. And I wondered, apart from the fact that that money can go toward continuing your work, I was wondering what it meant to you professionally and even emotionally to be acknowledged this way.
You know, I think it's a real honor. I was really surprised. I know that, Nat Geo, I'm probably the most controversial explorer that they've picked this year, and I'm probably the only one who really gets, I would say, hate mail. So I appreciate the fact that they are taking a chance by recognizing me and knowing that there probably will be a little bit of backlash. But I think it's also a testament to the fact that we're doing science and we're not this is not something else. This is just as rigorous and systematic as any other social science endeavor. And so I appreciate the fact that they recognize that. And I'm looking forward to getting, I think, a wider exposure for this project, to get people who don't necessarily read stuff about immigration to hopefully get at least exposed to this.
And if they do, if they click on, let's say, after hearing this and go to undocumentedmigrationproject.com and explore your work a little bit, what are you hoping they'll take away from it?
I'm hoping that they'll at least have more information about the complicated process of immigration. I mean, we've got the economics of it. There's hundreds of companies that profit from selling stuff to migrants as they cross the desert. That some of them are local, Mexican-based. Some of them are global corporations like Gatorade, Red Bull. So hoping to shine a light on the kind of global economic system that undergirds undocumented migration, but then also to see that there's a whole bunch of different ways of looking at this. I think the dominant narrative we tend to think about is this individual story of, someone who loses their life or someone who suffers greatly during this process. We want to highlight that each of these stories are important, but millions of people have gone through this process over the last 15 years, and we're trying to show that there's a wide range of experiences that people have, whether you're a Mexican national or a Central American who tend to fare much worse than Mexicans while crossing the desert or even crossing Mexico to get to the border. Thinking about the stories about Border Patrol, we do the archaeology of Border Patrol, the stuff that they leave behind in the desert, which is telling some interesting stories. So just kind of showing that this process on the surface seems like superficial and everybody sort of knows a lot about it. But when you look at what it looks like on the ground, all these things pop out. And every day I see something new and want to go off in a new direction to try to answer, other types of questions about this process.
Before I let you go, give me an example of some of the interesting head-turning things that you found from the Border Patrol.
Oh, with Border Patrol. Well, one of the things that's been – they leave a lot of stuff behind. And if you read the discussions on websites about the environmental impact of immigration, people oftentimes say very negative things about migrants, how they're trashing the Arizona desert. And we're coming to see, as others have shown more recently, that Border Patrol is probably having way more of a negative impact on the environment than migrants themselves, driving, creating illegal roads, destroying the environment with vehicle traffic, leaving tons of stuff behind. For example, they oftentimes use these giant tires that they drag behind on these to clear roads to check for footprints. And these things are pulled by big giant metal cables. These cables break and then these tires are just left behind. So if you drive through a national forest in southern Arizona, you will just see a lot of Border Patrol debitage left behind.
Interesting work done by Jason DeLeon, who's a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan and director of the Undocumented Migration Project. And again, you can learn more about his work by going to their website, undocumentedmigrationproject.com. Jason, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks, Cindy.
If you're a local in northern Michigan, especially in those tourist towns, you need a few places that are all your own. That dive bar visitors don't know, that private beach tucked away. For locals in Traverse City, one place like that is Inside Out Art Gallery. It's got strong drinks, and it's got a ban on touristy art. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells went to check it out.
You gotta like a gallery where the first thing you do is you get a drink at the full cocktail bar. Then you head out to the patio that has no view of the lake. It looks out over a parking lot and a couple old warehouses. But at least that's gonna guarantee that it will not be crowded with vacationers. And if it's a Wednesday night, you know that the true falsettos are gonna be playing. Susan Stedman and Nan Peterson are regulars here. They say the actual art part of the gallery is pretty good, too.
It's just avant-garde. It's fun to come with your friends and hang out and comfortable.
Traverse City is inundated with what I call tourist art. Watercolor paintings of cherries.
Some of which are
absolutely beautiful. It's just that there's enough of that.
This whole 7,000-square-foot renovated warehouse is the brainchild of one guy.
Hey, I'm looking for Mike.
Mike Kurtz is the gallery's founder, and the stuff in here is definitely not watercolors of cherries. Kurtz likes to describe it as outsider art.
There's, like, schizophrenic art. There's prison art. There's stuff that it's like, what the hell is inside there? And it comes out, and you go... fascinating.
Some of the stuff in here is a little twisted. There's a painting of the Flintstones having an orgy while dressed like satanic Nazis. Most of the work here, though, is pop art. Graphics that could have come from The Twilight Zone or...
Famous Monsters of Filmland, Mad Magazine, of course, 60s hippie underground comics.
Kurtz swears that this is not just the nostalgia of a guy in his late 50s. But it did start out as kind of a pipe dream, a passion project, if you will, after a colon cancer diagnosis about 10 years ago.
There was no electricity, there was no lighting, there was no heat. And I walked through and just went, wow, this would be so cool. Wouldn't this be cool? And then, you know, I'm like, I don't have any money, I don't have any time.
Kurtz says he was bartending at the time, and on good tip nights, he would go to the hardware store and pick up some more materials bit by bit. 9 years later, the gallery has gone through a massive expansion. They put in that full bar. They built a concert and movie theater space in back. But Kurtz's goal has never changed. No watercolors of cherries.
Say I find a lot of visual art, you know, absolutely, you know, boring as hell.
The thing is, Kurtz likes to paint this as if it is his gallery versus all the mainstream stuff downtown. But Traverse City does not seem to see it that way. The media here has written up a lot of adoring descriptions of the gallery. They've put it on Traverse City best lists. And even Mike Kurtz is willing to admit that there does seem to be a new, more progressive wave up north.
More people are coming up here via the film festival. Or the foodie New York Times articles. And a lot of those people are coming from, you know, San Diego or Chicago.
For now, though, this gallery is still just a small group of die-hard regulars. Like Sherry Bridgewater. She's a wine rep, and she started out selling wine to the gallery. And then she just kept coming back.
I'm just always here. It feels like someone's living room. There are tons of regulars. Pretty much everyone's a regular. You know everybody here.
Which makes for a really nice Wednesday night when you just get together to drink and talk art and look out over the parking lot in a darkening sky. In Traverse City, I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from a grant from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Today's show was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.